We're running a little behind schedule due to the enormous press activity at our first session. But I'd like to welcome you to the first of a series of presentations at this conference that deals with really the complexity of managing historical sound. So in this session and archival activities part two, which I hope you'll all also attend, discussions of the intersections of simply the physical storage of materials, audio preservation, management, and engineering that is involved in maintaining and preserving recorded sound of all kinds for posterity. Our first presentation is, as it says right up here, so far only one tie, the Commonwealth Club of California Broadcast Collection at the Hoover Institution Archives. And the Commonwealth Club of California is one of the largest public affairs forum in the United States, started recording its programs in about 1944, and now maintains really an entire archive of 64 years of those programs. And to give us their case study on managing this collection is Eric Jacobs with the Audio Archive in San Jose, the engineer and proprietor of that establishment. And from the Hoover Institution Archives, James Sam and Brandon Burke, and I do want to take just a brag moment here. Though I had nothing to do with the success, Brandon actually established the Archive of Recorded Sound at the University of Kansas, which when I started there, I had the pleasure to help administrate. So without any further ado, the Commonwealth Club of California Broadcast Collection, et cetera.
Thank you. Thank you, Roberta. It's very nice. What an easy act to follow from this morning, right? I'll cut right in since we don't have time. Again, this is going to be an overview of the management of the recorded sound segment of the Commonwealth Club of California collection at the Hoover Institution Archives. Hoover Institution began collecting in 1919, began collecting recorded sound in 1941. Approximately 5,600 collections, more probably, occupying roughly 25 miles of shelving. The collection emphases are quoted as war, revolution, and peace, but this equates to, for all intents and purposes, significant collections of Russian and former Soviet republics, China and Taiwan, economics, and of course, Herbert Hoover. Commonwealth Club of California is the nation's oldest and largest public affairs forum. It was founded in 1903 by San Francisco Chronicle editorial writer Edward F. Adams. To this day, it is a nonpartisan and nonprofit organization. Guests over the years have included nearly every president since its inception, many vice presidents, members of Congress, et cetera, as well as prominent scientists of nearly every ilk, educators, economists, writers, artists, chefs, athletes, and such. I should mention that sommeliers and one member of the Wu-Tang Clan have appeared in the
which I've And Marcel Marceau.
And Marcel Marceau, that's right. That one's a little hard to hear. We had to. First radio broadcast was 1924. The first recorded broadcast on lacquer disc was 3rd of March 1944. They currently broadcast on 150 public and commercial radio stations, C-SPAN, and recently YouTube. This is an active link, so when you get a copy of this later, if you purchase copies or see it streaming online, you can head to the club. The collection was acquired in 2003. Recorded sound formats include those listed. I'm going to go through some of these quickly because you can, again, read them later, but non-sound materials are those you would commonly find in a broadcast collection. There are two preservation queues we have working simultaneously, those selected for preservation and those for access. The usual rules apply here: visible structural deterioration, the lacquers would be an obvious example there, and known media instability, that's being one of our primary focuses in that arena. On-site user request is facilitated in the archives reading room, and that's where we would hear about such a request. Remote request comes from the club website through which we route the remote user requests, as it were. Metadata is recorded on two different MySQL back databases, one for the club itself and one for every item that's reformatted by our laboratory. The fields and structure of the database was designed by Hoover staff with significant help from Lisa Miller, who I see right there. Hi, Lisa. The databases were programmed by students, and significant portions of the descriptive metadata was performed by San Jose State University Library School interns. Kept the GUI simple, we avoided jargon with the knowledge that the raw or back-end data could be repurposed later, and avoided unnecessary graphics, and with the knowledge that only the client end needs to really be pretty. And I think the client end's pretty good, which you'll see at the end. This is what we see in-house. This would be the home page we come to, where we can choose to add or select a speaker for performing searches, go through everything by date if we would like. This is an example of one particular record. We're going to follow this record through for a few different slides here. This would be a Kirk Douglas appearance from, looks like July 12th of 1990. This would be a bit of the descriptive metadata followed by something about Mr. Douglas here. The speaker section is controlled vocabulary. One can either choose to select from speakers that have already appeared, which you see the drop-down box indicating there, or you can enter a new speaker. And then after such time, Mr. Douglas would appear when you next tried to enter in a recording. This is an example of two different carriers for this piece. We have an open reel tape and a cassette. Chose to use ACR2 format for recorded sound formats. Could have gone AES, but we started this in 2005, and it's already 3 years down the road, and that's not been published. So we decided to go with ACR2. And Jim will follow me up with a brief survey of formats and their related issues.
We have a lot of mediums here and for the collection, and as you can see, a good chart here. Lacquer discs, acetate reels, polyester reels, both 7-inch, 10-inch for both of them. DAT tapes, cassette tapes, IF files, CDRs. They're not on there, and I'll explain that later when I get to the reason why this slide was created. Lacquer, like you said, was started in 1944, created until 1954. Eric did the transfer of these before we had that lab set up that people saw yesterday, and he'll talk more about that transfer. The acetate tapes, second oldest medium, started in 58, and these are all full track 7-inch reels except for one reel, which is 10-inch full track. And the club switched to polyester in the summer of 73. It wasn't an abrupt switch. The first polyester reel was in June, followed by several events recorded on acetate, then a second polyester reel in July. The polyester reels, the 7-inch ones, are mostly full track, not all of them. When you get into the 90s, there's some dual mono half track stuff going on. But for the most part, especially the ones that are the original recording, they're all full track. The 10-inch ones are all dual mono half track, which makes things a little bit confusing when they're the master recording. They started in the 80s, were only sporadic for most of that time, then continued in gusto in the 80s and going through into the earlier part of this decade. Stick shed is rampant on these. Over half that I've looked at so far have had this problem. So there's a good chance that a good part of this collection is deteriorating as we speak. Digital audio tape, the club went digital in 1990. And they're using DATs of both 44.1 and 48. I haven't come across any 32s. It's been very, very rare, but there has been one or two DATs that had both sampling rates on it. And like Brandon said, these are currently high on our preservation queue because we're already seeing errors. He did some transfers of presidential candidates last summer, and some of the talks by Mr. McCain were already seeing significant errors. Digital files, earlier this decade, the club started just recording straight digital files, 44.1, 16-bit mono AIF files. They basically just swapped in the computer for the DAT machine, but this makes it a whole lot easier for us. And as you can see, the numbers for the amount of files that they're donating to us are increasing every year, and it's quite a bit. The club's engineer is using an Apple computer and formatting the drives in that style, which for our PC computers is a little bit of a problem in that we can't really read them without third-party software. It's an easy solution, but it's one more step that we have to go through. So what's the problem? The problem is, like as mentioned before, best practices state that you try to digitize the earliest recording possible, hopefully the original recording. Well, when you have several different copies of the same event, which one is the original recording? At the time of the recordings, the event gets captured onto one medium, and whether it be like the top, the middle line, the black disc, or a reel or something, there's only one copy of that. And then for the distribution to the radio networks, so you can hear it every week, they made polyester reels for syndication. Further complicating this is that some radio stations don't want the full program. They either want a 45-minute program or a 30-minute program versus the full hour. So looking at the stacks, there are sometimes four different copies of the same program. And the actual medium doesn't really tell us much either, because the word that the club's engineer has used to describe the methods of recording these programs succinctly is just chaotic. And that's pretty much the truth, is that, so for example, some like the Mr. Wozniak's talk in 1987 was recorded on a 7-inch reel, 10-inch copies. A year and a half later, Ron Paul was the exact opposite. So, you know, you look in the stack and say, hey, here's a 10-inch reel. This is the last format before DAT tapes. This probably isn't the master. Well, no, it is the master in that case. And the age of the format doesn't tell you much either, because on the bottom, the Murphy Brown infamous talk that Dan Quayle gave in 1992 was originally on a DAT, and copies are on 10-inch reels. As I alluded to, the information that the club's given us has been really, really helpful. It'd be really easy to mistake those 60-minute reels that are copies for the original, just simply because it kind of looks like that way, but it's not. And what makes it even more confusing is that on the spines of those radio copies, they use the term master pretty loosely. So you'll have 60-minute master, 45-minute master, 30-minute master, and none of them are the original recording. And the voice, if there's a voice stamp on the reel, it's a dead giveaway, because that was recorded by a radio production. Tape hiss is always helpful, as is crowd noise before or after the talk, because that's the most, edit that out before you edit anything else out to get the time down. Cassettes, they're up there because they're always a copy of the program. I mean, they might not be the best thing we have, but if that's all we have, that's all we have. When everything's digitized, it goes into our recording database. This is the descriptive data field. It's at the top of the database. It's a very macro view of the actual event. Who spoke, when, where, what they spoke about. And this is a continuation of that previous speech. This was actually chosen for this record for stupid reasons, where it's record 666 and it's talking about archival sources. Are you from Texas? Archival sources describes the after carrier, just the physical properties of that. Note field, basically any markings that are on the actual item or on the box. It's pretty self-explanatory where it is in the stacks, if it's real or not. This audio derivative, it just describes two things. It describes the actual file that's created, very loose metadata scheme for that, for the database. And the bottom part is the settings on the machine that were used to transfer them. And I try to get pretty geeky about the transfer notes section, adding if the reel was standard alignment recorded for azimuth, if any new reel was spun on, if it was the tape was spun onto a new reel afterwards, and stuff like that. These are the flags that get placed with the item after it's been digitized. The one on the left is way more common because it goes for everything. The one on the right is if we had to bake the tape. Tells you when we baked it, for how long, what temperature. Hopefully that'll be useful down the line. And on-site transfers, as some of you saw yesterday, we're using Studer brand machines that we inherited from RFE. A807s, A812s, they're regularly demagnetized and recalibrated, all that good stuff. We capture at 4824. It's this collection and most of our collections are voice recordings. So for us, that 48 is perfectly fine, sonically speaking, since we're not doing music. If you're doing music, I definitely recommend you do 9624. And DAS will transfer digitally. We're not doing a DA-AD conversion to get the audio for that. We're just transferring AES-EBU. And that's the on-site stuff. And Eric will now talk about the discs.
So I'm going to quickly speak about deterioration of the media. I did, you know, all the discs for them. Conservation, the transfer of the discs. We recorded a fair amount of technical metadata, and just a brief overview of the equipment that we used. Storage and handling problems, there were a great many of them. Fingerprints was probably the one that was most intrusive, because people, through either awareness or, you know, they would handle the discs, they weren't wearing gloves. The oil on your fingers is acidic, and, you know, 40, 50, 60 years later, those fingerprints turn into palmitic acid marks, which have etched their way into the sound. You can hear them. You can hear all the fingerprints as you're replaying these. And there was, you know, significant palmitic and stearic acid deposits on the discs, so we had to clean them all very carefully. Some of them were in pretty bad shape. They were cracked. They were peeling. Some were broken. Some had missing laminate. Some had deep scratches. These discs were played, I believe, possibly on the air, because I found gouges from dropped styli in the discs themselves, right in the laminate. They may have had a hard life here and there. Some were bent, some were dented, which creates a real challenge when you're trying to play them back. They may have been stored horizontally, so there were some deep impressions on some of them where you could see where the edges of the sleeve had just embedded themselves, those marks in the grooves. There was grease pencil where they were trying to indicate various things, and you know, we were curious. We wanted to know what they had eliminated. So we went back and we removed the grease pencil and transferred even the chunks that they had decided, you know, were not part of the official program, but noted that. They had tried to clean it, but they must have been just using tap water, so there were hard water deposits on the discs themselves, and, you know, trying to fix things up with cellophane tape, you know, and the cellophane tape was just kind of glued to the disc. So that was the kind of stuff that we were running into. Some quick pictures. That's a gouge that was of a needle dropped onto the laminate. We used 150 power microscope, so for measuring everything, and so, you know, we just hooked up a camera to the microscope to take some of these pictures. This is kind of interesting. It's an audio disc, and the palmitic acid, and I'm not 100% sure, but I think the ink must have a sort of acidic pH, and that combined with moisture in the air just made a nice copy of the audio disc label right onto the groove area. The next one's kind of interesting too. You can read the audio disc, but just sort of as a faint impression. I think here the label must have prevented some of the moisture coming through, and so moisture was the bigger issue here as opposed to the acidity of the label. There's our little piece of cellophane tape that we ran into here and there.
It's 12 or 16 inch?
These are all 16s. So disc conservation, always wear gloves. Just whenever you're contacting the laminate, just always wear gloves. I can't be more, yeah, that's really important. The other thing is when handling these are large discs, and particularly when they're cracked and broken, you need to really support them the entire time. So we made some custom platters to be able to manipulate them, to be able to move them from the cleaning machine to the playback device. If the disc was broken, we would sandwich them between these two plates so that we could flip the whole thing over without having to try to reassemble the pieces. And we really wanted to minimize any kind of stress on the discs themselves when they were compromised in any way. And then for storage, they were all put into new base buffered envelopes that didn't have folds over the edges that could one day leave impressions on the sides. They're all being stored nicely in boxes and they're upright. And the other thing that's really important for this particular media is that they be housed in a stable temperature and low humidity environment. And so we did a lot of research on the cleaning side of things, and we looked at the research that had been done by ARSC back in, I think it was the late 80s, and contacted some people, talked to chemists, and we finally came up with a solution that I describe here, which is a pharmaceutical grade distilled deionized water, a commercial solution from Disc Doctor as our cleaning base, and then we added clear ammonia to it. And that worked very well because what it does is it minimizes water contact time. Water is just the biggest enemy to nitrocellulose. So we wanted to make sure that, you know, because you can keep scrubbing these things, but you've got mechanical scrubbing, which is not great for a disc. Or you can keep doing cleaning over and over, trying to remove it, and that means more and more water contact time. So we really wanted to, that's why we advocated this approach. And we use special brushes, and we always clean both sides, even the blank side, because we want to keep the acidity, because palmitic acid is an autocatalytic reaction, so once it starts, it just accelerates. So you want to make sure that there's no acidic environment inside the envelope, so it's really important to clean both sides of the disc at all times. And fully support that disc during cleaning. None of the record cleaning machines, they all have 12-inch platters, but you put a 16-inch disc on it and you're applying any amount of pressure on the edge, that's bad, because you're starting to flex the substrate and you might delaminate the disc. This is our disc cleaning station. You can see just in this little clear thing over here, that was our support platter. It has a special bevel. You know, we experimented with lots of different bevels so that the water wouldn't come underneath the disc when we were running through the rinse and clean cycles. And as I mentioned before, we used a microscope to both inspect the grooves, look at how they were cut. We were measuring them to within 10 microns. We were using some custom styli with the appropriate stylus rake angle, and I'll show a picture of that. We used flat equalization. Listening is really important when you're doing oral histories, because the problem you run into with an oral history is if you get a skip with music, if you have music going in the background, maybe the beat changes, there's a sudden change in instrumentation, and your brain just catches it. Well, the problem with spoken word, the only thing that changes is context. You know, it's like you hear something, and then the words change, and like, that didn't make sense. You know, it seems like you should have said something before that. You know, and then you have to go back, and you're watching the stylus the whole time. These are very labor intensive, in fact. You can't walk away from them. And then, of course, with broken discs, we have to use different methods, like using slow speed transfers. We run it at a much slower RPM. And if you get skips, you know, that's another set of challenges that you have to deal with. And we did this all to broadcast wave format, you know, following the YAZA TCO4 guidelines, 2496. We chose 2496 not because the fidelity of the oral histories, but because the noise profile, the impulses, can be easily removed, or a little bit more easily removed, having an accurate depiction of that impulse. And we delivered the files to the Hoover Institution on portable hard drives. This is a picture of the station where we were doing all the work on. You can see the microscope there. It's got an optical fiber so that the light hits the disc, but there's no heating from the light onto the disc itself. Simon York turntable, a vibration isolator, a speed controller down the corner. This is just a quick shot. This is our stylus calculator that we were using. You measure different values, you put them into the box, you measure the top of the groove, the bottom of the groove. It gives you a range of styli. You know, it's impossible to just tell you this is the perfect stylus. But it will tell you which stylus is in the middle of the wall, it'll tell you which ones are within a reasonable range, and you know, anything in the yellow and the red, stay away from those size styli. So it gives you a good starting point so that you're not playing the record over and over to try to pick the right stylus. Over here, modern styli are made with an angled rake. And so if you really want to get the rake angle right, we had custom-made angle blocks put in so that we could take a modern cartridge and angle it appropriately so that the stylus was always vertical. I'm not sure anyone else actually goes through that trouble, but we did. And then this is just a listing of technical metadata you can download, or however, I don't know how they're going to distribute this, but if you want the technical metadata, just go to this. This is loosely based on the AES XO98 standard. I participate on that committee, so we use some of that information to put this together. And this is some more metadata. You can see all the stuff we're collecting on the playback and the digitization. And then this is a list of the equipment that we used, and you can also find that all in the presentation.
Thanks, sir.
You're welcome.
Okay, we'll quickly run through delivery and user access before wrapping up here. I realize we started late. There's an online search utility at the Hoover Institution Archives website, and in a perfect world, I can connect to it by clicking this button, but perhaps the world doesn't work in that manner, which is why I also included this shot here. And again, when you see this thing later, if you do, you can click on this yourself, or you can visit the Hoover Institution Archives website. But apart from a brief history of the club and such, and some photographs and some and one, at least one audio file you can hear on the web, there is a search utility. And were we to click Kirk Douglas's before, the same record that you saw in the video would show up, only in a nice, pretty form. Unfortunately, we can't see that. On-site use is limited to CDR access copies to be listened to in the archives reading room, remote use. The club routes its requests through us, and actually on our website it says to contact the club, and the club tells us what people request if we haven't delivered it to them already, and that way the club can also manage which programs have been requested, so they can keep track of that themselves. I have four audio clips for you for the end of this thing, so you can see some of the things we've done here. We didn't clean up this one at all. Frankly, at this point in time, we just want to get really fantastic transfers of what was exactly on the disc, and as soon as someone makes a reference request for this, well, then I'll worry about spending the time to clean it up. So this is Dr. Gerald Wendt, 21st of September, 1945. Oops, no, it isn't here.
In 1900, we had less than 2 million people in this country of 65 years old. Now we have 7.5. And when these advances of wartime medicine impinge upon us, we shall have, by the year 1960, 20 million people 65 years or older. Now that's, we'll get out a lot of pencils in the life insurance offices, I know. But it'll have lots of consequences. What do we do with 20 million people living on Social Security? We haven't ever thought of such a world as that.
Here's a clip of the Apollo 18 astronauts appearing on the club with a cute little comment about San Francisco.
The first question was not written by the mayor. What does San Francisco look like halfway to the moon?
I'm closest, I'll take that first one. As unfortunately, on the way out, I think most of this area was covered by clouds and we didn't get a chance to see it. And on the way back, there was such a small crescent that we couldn't see much of the Earth except that very small lighted crescent. So I'm afraid you'll have to ask another flight that question.
Third clip here is the classic Murphy Brown quote from 1992. Some of you have heard this 100 times, but it's worth repeating.
It doesn't help matters when primetime TV has Murphy Brown, a character who supposedly epitomizes today's intelligent, highly paid professional woman, mocking the importance of fathers by bearing a child alone and calling it just another lifestyle choice.
Okay, this is the really great one. You're gonna be, Jeffrey Skilling from Enron was hit by a pie with a pie protest. That was kind of a fun little thing folks were doing, at least in the early 2000s. And you're going to hear what happened at the club before they actually started the recording in earnest. So they started over again at the very end of this. But this is what happened in real time, and this was never aired.
And since 1990, when Jeffrey Skilling, today's Commonwealth Club guest, joined Enron, The company has transformed itself. We'll begin again in a moment. If there's anyone else in this audience that wishes to make a similar display, you will be dealt with very fiercely and formally. We will not tolerate that kind of behavior. Would you like to be next, ma'am? All right, we're going to begin the introduction again. We're going to wait until these people are removed, and then we'll begin again. I will remind you that we have question cards on your seats. You are perfectly willing, or rather, you are perfectly welcome to write your questions on those cards, and they will be asked to the best of our ability. We will not tolerate any outbreaks of that type. This is an educational forum. We're here to hear Mr. Skilling and to hear his side of the story. I think we will all be the better for it at the conclusion of this program. So let's be mature, and please give courtesy to the club and to Mr. Skilling. Okay, shall we begin again?
Sounds like a high school principal. And actually, that's the conclusion of our program. I would like to cut it short here so we can make sure and accommodate our friends that are next. So thank you, everyone. Are there questions? I didn't know whether we were going to do the lights now or later.
Yes, we can take a few questions now.
I actually have two, one for James and one for Eric. James, when you, I was looking in your transfer room yesterday, and yeah. I saw that you had one computer for the DAW and one computer for your data,
yeah.
I mean for your cataloging information.
Yeah.
Are those two computers at all connected?
No.
Or are you doing double entry?
No. The administrative computer there is there for the database, pretty much. And we do not ever want that production computer touching the internet as much as possible. Sometimes, it's to remain offline. But the administrative computer needs to be able to read the database. So that's why it's there, is to be able to read and write to the database. And communicate with the server in that sense.
So do you put markers in and name them on that computer, and then also name that in your database?
I'm not following. Markers that are put into access files are not noted in the database.
Okay, so you don't name them in the DAW at all. Do you name the files?
Yeah, the file names that. The unique identifier that appears in the database is used to create the file name for the file.
Okay. And then you enter that into your database?
Yes.
Okay. The file names are accession number underscore A for audio word and image, it would be I, underscore, and then the automatically generated number from the reformatting database, followed by a P01 if it's the preservation copy, R01 if it's the lower res file that would produce R02, which is a CDR. So in every further generation is an R or something. Unless you do two preservation copies, which would be PO2.
Thank you. Just a quick one for Eric. When you were cleaning the discs, you mentioned using various solutions, Turgitol, et cetera. Cleaning the grease pencil off or any other things like that, was there something extra that you had to use? I mean, sometimes that can be really stubborn.
It is stubborn.
Yeah.
little extra ammonia. So we popped it up maybe from 2% to about 5%. And that seemed to hold the grease pencil. We wouldn't try to get all the grease pencil off. We would perhaps get enough off so that we knew that the needle was going to go through there without skipping or doing anything funny. Again, trying to minimize the water contact time with the material. Right, good question. No adhesive. So we assembled it very carefully on the supporting platter and then moved that to the playback and played it back that way. Now sometimes we do have situations where the discs don't want to really stay together, in which case we'll just use some light, sometimes we'll use post-it pads because they just don't have, the adhesive doesn't seem to stick to things, and we'll just hold it together temporarily on
one
side.
So that's just for the transfer.
Exactly, and then we just pull it off.
And last question back here.
I'm curious, Jim and Brandon, if you what's your approach to the DATs in the collection? Have you taken any steps to survey them? What's your preservation plan for them?
We're going oldest to newest.
Oldest to newest.
We started the DATs with the ones where analog copies, I believe, stopped or.
Well, that's true.
And so we basically wanted to make sure that the stuff that didn't have any kind of backup anywhere was done first. And now we're just going in chronological order. That's it.
Be interesting to know if, as you start working your way through them, if there's any kind of... I'm really interested in finding ways of surveying that collection without having to just load each tape and find out how many errors are on.
There really is no rhyme or reason to which ones have errors. The vast majority of the ones that we've seen have been Quanji brand, both 64, 94, and 124. Whether it's 124, 94, or 64, it doesn't. I really haven't noticed whether that contributes to errors, because I have seen errors on 94 minute ones where 124 ones will be just fine. I don't recall seeing any errors on anything besides quantity DATs, but we only have I can hold on one hand how many other brands that we have that I've seen so far in that late 90s, early of this decade era that really gone through so far.